It is Friday, September the 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Pope continues his message to the American people with a reminder of the Golden Rule.
This rule points us in a clear direction. Let us treat others with the same passion and compassion with which we want to be treated.
Also ahead, China's leader in Washington for a state visit, plus the ongoing refugee crisis in Europe. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Good to have you with us. Pope Francis continued his visit to the United States Thursday by traveling from Washington to New York, where he was greeted by huge crowds, just like the ones here in Washington. Later today, he will be addressing the United Nations and conclude the day with a mass in New York's Madison Square Garden. Before leaving Washington on Thursday, Pope Francis spoke before a joint session of Congress. We get more now from VOA's Jeff Custer.
The Roman Catholic leader, the first pope ever to address the full U.S. Congress, was greeted warmly as he entered the chambers of the House of Representatives. His speech covered a wide range of issues, including the dangers of religious extremism and violence in the name of religion.
We know that no religion is immune from forms of individual delusion or ideological extremism. This means that we must be specially attentive to every type of fundamentalism, whether religious or of any other kind. A delicate balance is required to combat violence perpetrated in the name of a religion, an ideology, or an economic system.
The Pope did not shy away from controversial issues such as immigration, noting that most residents of North America are descendants of immigrants.
People of this continent are not fearful of foreigners, because most of us were once foreigners.
The Pope also cited the Golden Rule, treat others as you would have them treat you, as a reminder that all life is sacred.
The Golden Rule also reminds us of our responsibility to protect and defend human life at every stage of its development.
Pope Francis went on to talk about the distribution of wealth, the environment, and other issues. He closed, saying he hoped his talk reflected the culture, heritage, and spirit of a land which has inspired so many people to dream. Following his address to Congress, the Pope went to the west front of the U.S. Capitol, where he greeted the thousands of people who had watched the speech on the Capitol grounds and led them in prayer. He later went to a local church and adjacent homeless shelter where he shared a modest lunch with the poor.
Buen appetito.
And enjoy your meal.
Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
And as Pope Francis left Washington on Thursday, Chinese President Xi Jinping arrived for a state visit. Before plunging into the pageantry of that state visit, the two leaders met Thursday night for dinner and an informal chat. And even though there are numerous world issues to talk about, some analysts believe recent revelations of likely Chinese hacking of U.S. government and computers of corporations will dominate the discussions. International Edition's Victor Beatty speaks with China expert Bonnie Glazer of the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. She says the hacking is not a new issue. She said that President Obama, Mr. Xi, discussed the matter here in the U.S. in June of 2013 and then again last November in Beijing.
I think what President Obama will do is tell President Xi that the United States is serious about potentially slapping sanctions on China. If in the future the U.S. has more evidence that China is stealing trade secrets from American companies, I think that this information will be shared with Beijing. And if the Chinese government does not prosecute the company or individuals who are responsible, then I think that there will be the imposition of sanctions. And I think this is the message that Obama's going to convey.
In Seattle, one of the officials traveling with the president indicated that there might be some sort of cyber warfare agreement, a code of conduct, if you will, reached during this state visit. How likely do you think that might be?
Well, there have been reports of the possibility that the two countries will sign an agreement where they will not target each other's critical infrastructure. So that means, for example, electrical grids, maybe large water sources. I'm not so certain. There was a background briefing that was given by very senior administration officials, and that suggests that the expectations are not very high for such an agreement. But there's another possibility, and that is the establishment of a higher-level dialogue mechanism on cyber issues. But one of the problems with the existing mechanism is that it's very low level. It's run by Foreign Ministry and State Department, which, of course, on the Chinese side, the Foreign Ministry is very little clout. And it's very difficult to coordinate all the different parts of the system. Another problem is that since the United States indicted 5 PLA officers, the Chinese have suspended the talks. And so we don't have an effective dialogue mechanism. So creating a new one and making it higher level at least holds out the promise of making some progress on this issue in the future.
In remarks at Georgetown University earlier this week, National Security Advisor Susan Rice suggested that the U.S. will not be intimidated by territorial ambitions by China in the South China Sea.
Yes, the administration is talking tough on the South China Sea. That has been going on for quite some time. The rhetoric perhaps has gotten a little bit sharper this year and in recent months. But the administration really is not doing very much in action. There have been reports ever since May that the Obama administration is considering conducting freedom of navigation operations by sending either aircraft or ships into the 12 nautical miles around an artificial island that used to be a submerged reef over which no country could actually have sovereignty and therefore has no entitlement to a territorial sea around it. But we have not seen that happen. Indeed, in hearings last week at the Senate Armed Services Committee, the Defense Department's assistant Secretary of Defense David Scheer confirmed that the United States has not sailed within those waters since 2012. So again, growing pressure on the administration to do more than just talk tough.
Bonnie Glazer of the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies. She was speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. Now it's time to catch up with International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who's here about what's being said on Twitter about President Xi's visit to Washington. Hey, G, what are some of those hashtags being used by the people on Twitter?
Hi, Steve. I know it's not that exciting, but hashtag Xi Jinping is the most popular hashtag to use in this case. In the last 24 hours, that hashtag was used in nearly 2,700 tweets. Another hashtag the Chinese media outlets are using a lot is hashtag Xi USA Visit, but I don't think that's as easy to remember as, say, Pope in D.C. or Xi Jinping. Only slightly more than 1,000 tweets used hashtag Xi USA Visit, and most of them, I have to say, are from the state-run media outlets in China.
Yeah, Ji, and speaking of that, what are some of the Chinese media outlets such as Xinhua and CCTV tweeting?
Great question. Now, both of the accounts have tweeted multiple times about the visit Thursday. The Xinhua news agency at XH News on Twitter sent out this tweet. Chinese President Xi Jinping in the United States for a state visit at the invitation of U.S. President at Barack Obama. That's been marked as a favorite more than 800 times. Steve, I want to ask you and of course our listeners, how often do we see President Obama tagged on Twitter at the handle at Barack Obama?
Well, probably not too often and for good reason.
Exactly. At Barack Obama is an account run by Organization for Action Staff. So instead, we usually use at POTUS, which is an acronym for President of the United States.
Tell us what the U.S. media is saying about all of this.
Sure. An article posted on our Facebook page, which is VOA Asia, is getting a lot of attention, reaching more than 6,000 users as we speak. It's titled, Agenda for Obama, Xi to Include North Korea's Threats. Pyongyang in recent weeks have been warning the international community about rocket launch and nuclear tests. And while the leaders are going to have in-depth discussion about North Korea, experts say they're probably not going to take a stronger stance on the issue. Steve?
And many thanks to you, Chi. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, President Xi will move on to New York from Washington, where he will join other world leaders, all of them attending the annual United Nations General Assembly. President Obama will be there, so will Russian President Vladimir Putin, and they're expected to meet with one another during the events next week at the UN. We get more now from Charles Maines in Moscow.
The meeting between the leaders of the United States and Russia in effect ends a standoff over direct talks after the two men fell into disagreement on a number of issues, including the war in Ukraine, Moscow's support for Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad, and a rollback on democratic rights within Russia. A White House official said Thursday the meeting came at President Vladimir Putin's request and reflected President Barack Obama's desire not to waste an opportunity. Given the situation in Ukraine and Syria, despite our profound differences with Moscow, the president believes it would be irresponsible not to test whether we can make progress through high-level engagement with the Russians, the U.S. official said. He said the president would take advantage of this meeting to discuss Ukraine and focus on ensuring that Russia lives up to its commitments to uphold the ceasefire agreement reached between Ukraine's government and Russian-backed separatists. But later, a Kremlin spokesman said the meeting is taking place by mutual agreement, and Syria would be the primary issue discussed. He added that talks on Ukraine would be included if time allows. The Kremlin, meanwhile, continues to ferry arms and personnel to a Russian military base in Syria's coastal Latakia province. Moscow-based analyst Dmitry Oreshkin says the Kremlin's political calculus here was obvious all along. Putin needs the West to have no choice but to meet with him, says Oreshkin. He's already sent troops into Syria, so he's a player, and now the conditions are set for a deal. Just what deal Putin might seek is open to speculation. Earlier this month, Putin called for Western powers to join Russia in an international terrorism campaign aimed at wiping out ISIS and other terrorist threats. Observers say Putin may seek to trade Russian cooperation in Syria for an easing of Western sanctions imposed over Russia's actions in Ukraine. Just how receptive Mr. Obama might be to such a proposal is questionable. In comments to U.S. media, a White House spokesman insisted Mr. Obama's core message to Putin would be making sure the Russian leader finally lives up to commitments aimed at securing a lasting peace in Ukraine. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
And for more on this story and the rest of the hour's news, check out our website at voanews.com. And you know, you can also follow International Edition on Twitter. Our handle is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. UN World Food Program is playing a major role in that ongoing migrant and refugee crisis. Most of those people fleeing to Europe from Syria, where the WFP says conditions continue to deteriorate. The agency assisting millions of people from Syria and many others who fled to neighboring countries. In Cairo, Abir Atefa, the World Food Program's senior spokesperson for the Middle East and North Africa, speaks with VOA's Jodi Kabwa about the WFP's humanitarian operations during the migrant and refugee crisis.
Well, over the last 5 years, the World Food Program has been working to feed over 6 million people displaced by the conflict in Syria. That includes around 4 million people who are uprooted and displaced inside Syria, in addition to another 1.8 million people who fled Syria and became refugees in the neighboring countries. Families receive consistently monthly food baskets in inside Syria. That includes the staple food commodities, that's rice, wheat, flour, vegetable oil, canned food, the basic food items. In the neighboring countries, refugees receive food vouchers. Some of these vouchers are actually electronic cards, whereby they go to local shops in the neighborhood where they live, and they can redeem these vouchers against food items from supermarkets. And this allows them to get access to fresh food, like, you know, fresh dairy products or fruits and vegetables.
Many UN agencies have had the same complaint recently that they do not have enough funding. What about your funding levels?
It's been an ongoing program for the last 4 years, consistently giving refugees access to food every month, and we haven't missed a month. But funding has been extremely difficult since the beginning of the year, which has forced us to reduce the value of our assistance, that now refugees in the neighboring countries are only getting half of what they used to receive. And this basically translates into less than 50 cents a day for a refugee to put food on the table for himself or herself. And also for the families inside Syria, the size and the quantities of the food has been reduced by around 25%. So people are receiving definitely less food.
So how much more money do you need to restore rations to their previous levels?
In order for us to restore these rations to previous levels and to also add these people that we had to cut off from our assistance this month, we need around $237 million from now until the end of December. And it's been a difficult challenge for the World Food Program because it's been hand-to-mouth operation. So what happens is that, you know, we receive funding that would allow us to go for a month or two. And then after 2 months, we crash again. And what we need is predictable and sustainable form of funding. This crisis is not going away. And until a political solution is found, the needs are still there and they need to be met.
Abira Teffa is the World Food Program senior spokesperson for the Middle East and North Africa, and she was speaking from Cairo with VOA's Joe DeCapua. A stampede on the outskirts of Mecca killed at least 717 people, injured more than 800 others during the annual Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia. Faithful visit the site to throw rocks at pillars representing the devil in a final ritual before beginning the Eid al-Adha holiday. As foot traffic flowed one way mid-morning on Thursday, a small group turned around, creating an unintentional clash that crushed men, women, old, young, everyone. The stampede was the second mass fatality for pilgrims this month, following a crane collapse that killed 109 people in Mecca. On a happier note, Muslim Americans are celebrating Eid. International Edition senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi visited an Eid celebration by Muslim Americans in Northern Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. Our colleague Jim Stevenson asked him about the basic characteristics of the celebration.
Well, Muslims observe and prepare for Eid al-Adha in a number of steps. Before the festival, the faithful acquire new clothing and gather with family and friends. And at Eid's dawn, Muslims recite the traditional declaration of faith, the takbir, praising God, and followed by the pre-sunrise communal prayer or Salat al-Eid. American Muslims gather in large groups for the prayer. This specific group has a small Islamic center that cannot absorb the large numbers of worshippers, so they perform Eid prayers at a nearby church, as Omar Abdurrahim explains.
What we have been able to do, and what other Islamic centers as well have been able to do, is to reach out to the local community. And some of these centers consist of churches, community centers, could be synagogues. And what happens is we're able to establish a relationship with these organizations to utilize their facilities for our worship services.
One important aspect of the prayers is to listen to a sermon calling on Muslims to feed the poor.
What follows the pre-sunrise prayers, Muhammad?
Well, today it's marked by slaughtering animals to feed the poor. As a symbolic act, Muslims who can afford it slaughter a cow, a goat, or a sheep, keeping a portion to feed themselves and distributing the rest to the needy. Worshippers then greet friends with the traditional Arabic salutation, Eid Mubarak, which means have a blessed Eid, and then exchange gifts. Coming at the end of the Hajj, a journey of dedication or purification, the Eid celebration means for Muslim Americans, there are few days before they welcome their loved ones who performed pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia.
International Mohammed Edition senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi
speaking very much
for our colleague Jim Stevenson. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
It's pretty much the best spot to have a tiny little staycation.
Mike Akins is one satisfied customer spending a New York City night sleeping in a taxi. That's right, a yellow taxi converted into a street-side hotel with a bed, which is cleaned every day with new sheets and fresh flowers by owner Jonathan Pally, a former stand-up comedian.
A lot of people come from Europe and Asia, and I love meeting people. I have people from Finland right now.
Pally started listing his taxi hotels for rent 6 months ago on the room-sharing site Airbnb. He's got several of them now, and his four-wheeled hotels are booked.
Yeah, my reviews are like 4.5 to 5 stars.
So far, Pally's business barely breaks even, but for $22 a night, his innovative tiny accommodations on wheels are nearly 10 times cheaper than any room you'll find around the Big Apple. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Superstar diva Beyoncé's father, Matthew Knowles, says that there might be a reunion of the group that launched his daughter's career. That's Destiny's Child. However, as International Edition's David Byrd and VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee tells us, that might be more wishful thinking than reality.
So we're talking about Beyoncé, Kelly, and Michelle.
And
okay,
their father.
Beyoncé's father, Matthew Knowles, technically manages Destiny's Child. Now, each of these ladies have gone on to do their own thing as solo artists. And so he's kind of sitting around without much to do and happened to do an interview with Huffington Post recently and said, hey, I'm working on a Destiny's Child project. I'm hoping to get the girls back together so that they can tour and do an album. And he says he's working on a new book. It will be a Destiny's Child autobiography, he says, and he's also working on a deal, shopping it around with some television and maybe even movie studios. We're thinking Destiny's Child biopic, perhaps. Now, this is what he's saying.
You ain't running game. Say my name, you acting kind of shady, ain't calling me baby, better say my name.
The other day, I would call, you would say, baby, how's your day, but today.
It is also important to note, however, that Beyoncé, his daughter, no longer works with him. She fired him as her manager, as a solo artist. But apparently, technically and legally, he still manages Destiny's Child as the unit. So he has the ability to say these things. And I guess if the girls agree, he would be managing and releasing these projects as well.
Yeah, but it's a well-known fact that Jay-Z is kind of in charge of Beyoncé's career now, right? Isn't he?
I wouldn't say Jay-Z is in charge of her career. I would say Beyoncé is in charge of Beyoncé's career. But Jay-Z definitely, as her husband and as a mogul himself, definitely has more influence over her career than her father has had in many, many years.
Yeah, I was speaking more from the business end, not the relational end, that, you know, her husband is being a hip-hop mogul, is not going to want anybody trying to kind of wriggle their way in to the business end of her career.
Right. But again, I think it's also important to note that she fired him.
Right.
They don't have a very good relationship. So I don't think Jay-Z has anything to worry about, because I don't think Beyonce will allow Matthew Knowles to wiggle his way back into her career.
All right. Well, we'll see if this actually comes to pass. If you have any comments about this subject or anything you hear on our show, you can send a tweet to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hook up with her at VOA_music. And be sure to listen for her in the Soul Lounge. You can find that on our website, voanews.com.
Now that you're out of my life, I'm so much better. You thought that I'd be weak without you, but I'm stronger. You thought that I'd be broke without you.
That'd get a whole lot better than Destiny's Child. It would be nice if the three of them would get back together again. Don't you think? Yeah, everyone raised their hands. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not to mention that they were very attractive to watch entertain. Not to mention that. But I mentioned it anyway. One of the most popular songs in history could soon be entering the public domain after a federal judge here in the United States out in Los Angeles ruled this week that the longstanding copyright on Happy Birthday to You was invalid. For decades, the rights to the century-old song have changed hands until the Warner Chappell Publishing Group scooped it up back in 1988 and began to aggressively protect their copyright by charging royalties for the use of Happy Birthday to You in movies and TV shows. However, a federal judge says that doesn't work. That only applied to a specific piano arrangement. Anyway, the efforts to unshackle Happy Birthday to You from its copyright were spearheaded by a group of filmmakers working on a documentary about the song. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Cornelius Tenner, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Muhammad Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.